The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. A January poll from ABC News Washington Post found that 40% of the participants supported impeachment of the current president, Donald Trump. Bookmakers claim there is a 59% probability that Trump will be impeached during his term. But what that doesn't mean Trump would be actually removed from office. Why not? Well, impeachment is complicated. We're going to be diving into the mechanics, the history of presidential impeachment, and other ways to remove U.S. presidents. We're not talking about whether or not to impeach Donald Trump. That's a conversation that would get ugly and mean and not helpful. So let's just get a better sense of what impeachment is. How would that look? How would it work for the nation? But there's lots of ways for you to get into the conversation, to ask your questions and comments about that. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You can email your questions and comments to the source at tpr.org and tweet at us at TPR Source. We're joined this hour with David Priest, the former CIA intelligence officer, author of the book, How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives, and David Crockett, chair of the Political Science Department at Trinity University. And both Davids, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
We have a glut of Davids on the show today.
A glut of Davids, for sure. David Priest, you wrote the book, How to Get Rid of a President. When you wrote this book, were you thinking about the current president?
Well, I was, because I had finished my first book, The President's Book of Secrets, which details all of the ways that presidents in the modern era have received intelligence reports. And it really was a positive story about presidents in that most of them treated that role very seriously and incorporated intelligence into their foreign policy decision making. So I was looking for a different way to look at the presidency, and I decided to look at how presidents who have broken bad are treated. That is, how presidents end up leaving office. And that was right around the time in the 2016 election period when we had people talking about both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, the two major party candidates, as perhaps the likeliest candidates to be impeached immediately upon taking office. So the thought was in my mind that we needed a deeper conversation than just a knee-jerk reaction to, I don't like this person, let's talk about impeachment. We needed a richer understanding of our history of all of the ways that Americans have removed or tried to remove presidents.
And David Priest, a detail that people really need to remember is that just because you're impeached doesn't mean that you're kicked out of the Oval Office. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The impeachment is closely resembling an indictment. That is, it is charges brought against the president for any number of things, loosely categorized as either treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors. The House of Representatives determines that by a simple majority vote. Impeaching a president, not necessarily that hard procedurally, but that is only the beginning. To remove the president based on the charges of impeachment, you need to have what the Constitution calls a trial in the Senate of the United States, presided over by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And in that process, two-thirds of senators must vote to remove the president from power, essentially convicting the president of the charges brought by the House of Representatives. So it is a two-stage process, the impeachment being the rebuke for doing bad things, and then the Senate voting to actually remove the president based on those bad things.
And Professor Crockett, when people talk about impeachment of a president, they're generally in the popular vernacular talking about removing the president.
Yeah, I think that's the common misconception. Usually when I talk to my students about this, I ask them what an impeachment is, and they say kicking him out of office. So that gives me the teaching opportunity to correct them on that.
Right, and we can bring up that Bill Clinton was impeached and still remained in office.
Yeah, exactly. So my students normally think that Nixon was impeached. He was not. Clinton and Andrew Johnson were, failed to convict, I think. Nixon would have been convicted had it gone that way, but he was actually never impeached because he resigned. before those articles were voted on in the House.
David Priest, when we say that there's never been a successful impeachment in the United States, I know that you can argue that Richard Nixon may have been because he resigned, so it sort of worked out.
Right. The way I put it in my book is that Richard Nixon, although he was not convicted on charges of impeachment, he left office as a result of the impeachment process. He would not have resigned if he did not see the writing on the wall that he was about to be impeached and removed. It is virtually certain that would have happened. So in a sense, the impeachment process worked. The reason that the founders wanted to have an impeachment process was that so an unfit president would not remain in office for the rest of his term. Well, guess what? Richard Nixon resigned, but the impeachment process did its job.
So the founders' intent, that seems to be critical here. We know the three categories of bribery, treason, high crimes and misdemeanor. What is that, David Crockett?
Well, treason is actually one of the few crimes, maybe the only crime that's actually defined in the Constitution. So I'm going to flip through my Constitution here real quick, but in Article 3 of the Constitution, there's actually a definition of treason. And treason consists of levying war against the United States or adhering to our enemies, giving them aid and comfort. So that's treason. Bribery would be using the office for corrupt gain, and I would think that includes both giving a bribe or taking a bribe, and then you have other high crimes and misdemeanors, which are things that are similar to treason and bribery.
Still pretty vague there, David Priest.
Mm-hmm. It is. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. We don't know a lot about what the founders meant by high crimes and misdemeanors because the records of the Constitutional Convention are not complete. They're largely based on James Madison's notes and a few other snippets. So we don't know exactly what they meant by it. And we only have a little bit of their debate. It appears that the main debate that happened was whether the president should, in fact, be impeachable and removable for something other than treason and bribery. And sure enough, you had one of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention bringing up what he called maladministration or bad governance. And James Madison objected and said, well, wait a minute. If somebody can be kicked out of office for just not doing a good job in that general of a sense, you would have a president basically serving at the will of the Congress. It would be essentially a no-confidence vote like we see in parliamentary systems. So how about we do something more specific? And they came up with high crimes and misdemeanors, a phrase which did not get much debate. Now, that tells us only a few things. One is enough people in the room, perhaps tired after they'd been negotiating all of this new U.S. government for months, basically said, yeah, that sounds okay. There's nothing inherently wrong with it. And they moved forward. But we also know that it is not maladministration. We know that it must mean something more specific, or else Madison would not have said that. Also, the history shows us that the founders and the generation after were not shy about amending the Constitution when they saw things they had done wrong. We had something like 12 or 13 amendments within the first 15 years after the Constitution passed. If high crimes and misdemeanors had been seen to be so bad and so useless, then they could have changed it, and they chose not to. They wanted us to retain that flexibility in the future.
What does high crimes and misdemeanors mean to you, listener? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. We're talking about removing a president, how that would work. There's lots of different ways that has happened in the past. We'll talk about that coming up. The number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The source continues right after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about how to remove a president. With us right now is David Priest. He's the author of How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. David Crockett, Chair of the Political Science Department at Trinity University. David Priest, we have the 25th Amendment. What is that? What is it used for? Has it been used in the past?
The Constitution said from the beginning, David, that a president who was unable to perform the duties of the office would be filled in as acting president by the vice president. The problem was the original Constitution did not define, other than something like death, what it would mean that the president was unable to perform the duties. Thus, we had cases like Woodrow Wilson, who had a massive stroke in his second term, was effectively disabled for much of the rest of his term, and for many months at a time, did not see anyone outside of a small circle and appeared to have decisions being made by his doctor and his wife. That is certainly not what the founders had in mind. So finally, in 1967, Congress passed the 25th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that was more specific, that defined a process by which the president's disability could be activated, and if the president disagreed, how he could push back. The basics of it are simple, which is, according to Section 3 of that amendment, the Congress is out of it. It is up to the vice president and the majority of the cabinet, and if they agree the president is unable to perform his duties, the vice president becomes acting president. If the president disagrees, he can immediately say, no, I'm fine. Ultimately, that could go to a vote in the Congress by which both houses of Congress have to have a two-thirds vote that the president is in fact disabled and the vice president remains acting president. That has never happened. We haven't had that back and forth between the vice president and the president. The only declarations of disability we've had under the 25th Amendment have been totally voluntary when the president has gone into a surgery and handed power over temporarily to the vice president.
Yeah, I think that's only happened three times, once with Ronald Reagan when he went into surgery, cancer surgery, and with George W. Bush when he was having two colonoscopies. So Dick Cheney was president during those few.
Right on. And it went smoothly. It went smoothly. The time that it perhaps should have been invoked was when Reagan was shot in 1981. And no one involved invoked the 25th Amendment, even though he was clearly disabled and unable to exercise the powers and duties of the presidency for a short period of time. But at least we have the precedent established that a president can declare himself disabled. We just don't have the precedent by which the vice president looks in the president's eyes, assuming he's conscious, and says, sir, I don't think you're up to the job. That is a very high bar to cross.
And David Crockett, so when we had President Wilson, it was basically President Weekend at Bernie's. It was, you know, putting on a show, dressing him up and driving him around in his Pierced Arrow around Washington, D.C. But Edith Wilson was making all the decisions, even signing the documents. That seems crazy now, but, you know, why wasn't anyone pushing back?
Well, his wife and his doctor were keeping very close guard over him. They were jealously guarding his position and authority and preventing even people like the vice president from coming in there and seeing exactly what was going on and preventing any effort to try to change the situation where someone who was competent could be responsible for making decisions. So they had gatekeeper power over that.
It just shows you how different things are now today, the responsibilities of a president. And you wonder if with the same sort of yardstick that we use to gauge a president in our past is still appropriate in our current situation.
Yeah, I don't see how in the modern era something like that could have happened, because the media inquiry would have penetrated that inner sanctum, I think.
All right, let's go to...
I think so.
Go ahead,
David. Let me hit one thing there. Yeah, to respond to the good doctor, It's funny, I tend to think the same thing, and then my mind goes in a dark place, which is, let's say that the current president is in his residence, and he's watching TV with executive time or whatever it's called on his schedule, and nobody sees him for a week on end, and there are rumors that something has happened, but the vice president or Melania or anybody comes out and says, no, he's fine, he's just spending time by himself. I actually don't see a furor. I see a lot of questions, but I'm not sure I see the vice president walking in there and saying, I must become acting president.
Let's go to the phone lines, 210-614-8980. Melissa is on the line. Hi, Melissa. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. It's occurring to me that, you know, over the recent decades, we have given so many powers to the president that, first of all, I think that we may... The better thing to do besides impeachment right now would be to start removing some of them, because he has so many. It's hard to really control his behavior through impeachment, especially since it takes so long. It will probably be in the election period, or somebody new may be elected before we get around to being able to impeach him or or anyone else.
Melissa, thank you for the call. So what has governed presidents in the past has been the power of the norm. What are accepted norms of how a president behaves and how they will carry out their duties and the quality of people that they will appoint to the cabinet. And it seems like that really isn't holding up anymore. And we're finding out that there isn't a lot of ways to actually keep that president in check. Is that something that you see happening, David Priest?
Yeah, it's interesting because we have something now that many observers did not anticipate, which is in the first 2 years of this presidency, this is the ideal textbook case absent practice. But just looking at theory, when the separation of powers is supposed to kick in, when the Congress is supposed to say, wait a minute, we've gone too far with the imperial presidency deferring to the executive branch, we're going to take back some of those rights. And in fact, back in June 2015, just as Donald Trump was entering the presidential race, there was an article in The Atlantic by John Lovett that was actually a brilliant piece. He was pretending to be writing a look back at a Trump presidency, which was considered virtually impossible at the time. And in his article, he wrote about what happened when Trump miraculously won the election, about all of the things that Congress did with a wink and a nod from the Supreme Court to essentially emasculate the presidency and make it almost an empty office. But that's not what happened. What happened is the president came in and partisanship seemed to trump separation of powers. So we haven't had that pushback against the strong presidency except in little bits here and there. The interesting thing to watch politically, of course, will be what happens now that one of the houses of Congress is under Democratic control instead of Republican control. Will we see that institutional pushback now?
David Crockett, chair of the Political Science Department at Trinity University. The power of the presidency, I mean, it depends on who's in the Oval Office?
Well, I would argue that there is a natural power that goes to the presidency, especially during times of crisis. Over the years, the genetic code of the presidency as a unitary figure has allowed power to flow in that direction. This is a long process that Congress has sort of been complicit in, and it's only been exacerbated by partisan polarization because now members of Congress who are in the president's party see it as more important to forge alliances with him to get their way than to have institutional pride in pushing back against an overweening executive. But that's not a new thing with Donald Trump. That's been going on for a few presidencies now.
Right. But do you think the legislature could gain more power moving forward, David Crockett?
Well, absolutely. They can do it anytime they want to. Congress is the first branch of government for a reason, which is that if they really wanted to and they had the majorities to do it, they can do anything they want to. They can cut over the president, and it's happened at least once in American history, but you just have to have the will of that branch to make it happen.
And David Priest, going back to the 25th Amendment, there were times when it was brought up during the last days of Ronald Reagan's presidency because there were people who said that he was in mental decline. We know 5 years after he left the office, he was publicly diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
Right. This is an issue that there's some disagreement about. Most of the people who worked in the White House talked about Ronald Reagan as late in the second term being more easily distracted, focusing less, but clearly not disabled in decision-making the way that the people who drafted the 25th Amendment had in mind. They had most clearly in mind a hypothetical, which is what was an assassination of John F. Kennedy. If that had been a coma of the president, the Constitution was not clear how you got to an acting presidency. But with Reagan, most people around him said, yeah, he was more difficult to get focused and we had to channel his attention, but he was capable of making decisions. We would bring decisions to his attention and he would make them. But that doesn't mean that it was the idealized form of the presidency. In fact, his three top national security advisors, the national security advisor, Colin Powell, the Secretary of Defense, Frank Carlucci, and the Secretary of State, who was George Shultz, every morning they would get together and the three of them would decide, even if they violently disagreed on a policy option, the three of them would decide what are the three of us unified going to suggest to the president, because they knew the president would probably not overrule it if the three of them agreed. So they resolved their differences before they went to the president to not force him to negotiate between them. Now, is that a sign of an unable president? Not completely, but it is a sign of the system working around a president who is not functioning the way he had even 5 years previous.
How does the 25th Amendment actually work? How would you invoke it, David Crockett?
The 25th Amendment?
Yeah. Or David?
Yeah, you just have to the vice make a decision to invoke that and work with a majority of the cabinet. So you're going to have a consensus of most of the political appointees of the president who work in the cabinet that he is not capable of doing his job, and then invoking the 25th Amendment to remove him and have the vice president become the acting president.
David Priest,
great fodder for political thrillers.
Right. So David Priest, they just put together a letter, a document,
yeah,
and bring it to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. How does that work?
Yeah, it's wonderful. Constitutional scholars can debate on the head of a pin on issues like this. The actual text of Section 3 says something like, and pardon me if I get a word wrong here, but something like, whenever the president transmits to the president pro tempore, or the acting president of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, his written declaration that he is unable to discharge the powers, then he hands them over. But similarly, the vice president can do the same by making a transmittal. Now, usually a transmittal has been defined as the provision of a letter to the Speaker of the House and the President pro tem of the Senate, and that would immediately trigger the action. Now, it gets really fun when you try to decide, well, if the letter is received, but the president immediately sends another message, who is the acting president for those minutes? Hopefully we never get to a scenario where the exact date, time of the delivery of a letter between two competing centers of executive authority decides who has the power of the presidency.
So you would need the majority of the cabinet members, cabinet secretaries to sign off on that, David Priest?
Yeah, it's the vice president. And I believe the text they use in the 25th Amendment is something like the majority of the chiefs of the executive departments. But that is normally interpreted to mean the cabinet.
So now, what about acting cabinet members? Seeing how we have more and more acting and not fully confirmed cabinet members, how does that fit in?
It is not written in the text of the constitutional amendment. Therefore, it is open to interpretation. And one could imagine a scenario, again, one we hope we do not get to, but you could imagine a scenario in which there is the vice president and half of the cabinet, and then the deciding vote is an acting secretary. Well, by most interpretations, that would meet the conditions of the 25th Amendment. But I have seen it written from others who have looked at this and said, that is easily something that's contestable. Now, the Supreme Court would be loath to intervene in a case like this. They usually like to see what they call these political questions resolved by negotiations between the branches. In this case, it might even be within a branch that they're trying to figure out what the story is. But at least there could be a valid court challenge to whichever way that decision went if an acting secretary is a deciding vote.
All right. So we bring this up because it's history. It's part of how we decide who's going to lead the president, and lead the country in these very trying times. It's been brought up in coverage of the current White House. There have been some reports that there was a talk of invoking the 25th Amendment. There is certainly talk about efforts to impeach the current president, Donald Trump. There have been members of Congress that have brought it up. Motions have been brought to the floor, resolutions. So this is something that is current in the news, and we're going to be talking about how it would work, not necessarily about Donald Trump himself, but about the mechanisms. If you got questions or comments, 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. In order to impeach and remove a president of the United States, you have to have a simple majority of the House of Representatives, but then you need two-thirds majority of the Senate. 67 senators need to vote to convict the president. That has never happened in U.S. history, a high threshold, but it does make it harder for partisan issues to drive an impeachment, probably what the founders had envisioned when they put that two-thirds majority in the Constitution. What do you think about efforts, talk of removing the president of the United States? How would that work? How would that play for the nation, the weight that it would have on the nation. Call in. The number is 210-614-8980. David Priest, you wrote the book, How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. There are other ways to get rid of presidents, and we talked about impeachment, the 25th Amendment, but there's also assassinations happen. Presidents right. have been removed from office through assassination because individuals did not like their policies.
That's right. Taking apart impeachment and a declaration of disability, which we have discussed, let's just quickly hit the methods from the intended to the unintended or the expected versus the exceptional. The first is the simplest, which is the founders devised a system by which we could actually remove the chief executive every 4 years. A president runs for re-election, the people say you're fired, and that president is gone. But it doesn't have to get to election day, because what used to happen in the 19th century, much more often than recently, is the party itself looked at their incumbent president and said, oh, he's not doing a great job, we can do much better. And they nominated someone else instead. That is also a removal. The president wants to stay in, and the party itself rejects him. Short of physical removal from the office by an election or by not being put on the ballot by your own party, you can have what I call a removal in place, where a president still holds the title, still performs the duties and powers of the presidency, but in a sense, they've been boxed in. They're not what we would call a complete and total president. One of the examples I write about in the book is that of Andrew Johnson, who succeeded Abraham Lincoln. Andrew Johnson had some legislation passed against him that was later ruled unconstitutional, that did things like said, Mr. President, we won't even allow you to remove some of your cabinet secretaries without getting Senate approval. He was still in office, but in a sense, he was removed from some of the powers and duties of the office. You can also, yes, resort to force, and we don't recommend that. There's no way that one person's will should override that of 300 plus million people, but we have had four assassinations and many other assassination attempts that I write about in the book. Thankfully, in this country, our experience is that assassinations are relatively rare because of all of these other methods we have. We have not had to resort as often as most other countries through the long span of history have to taking out the leader by overthrowing the leader.
Well, you write in the book that even to John F. Kennedy commented that anyone who wants to kill the president, they can. It's not that hard. And he goes into detail about how you could do it with the telescopic rifle, from a high position. So we can admit that it's probably not that difficult if someone was determined. Is it David Crockett, let me get you ask you this. Do you think the fact that making a president a martyr is probably the best deterrent?
I suppose it could be for rational coup energizers, but you got to figure three of the four people who were successful assassins are lone nut jobs. I mean, only John Wilkes Booth actually has a conspiracy motivated around a contemporary political agenda, but the people who assassinated Garfield, McKinley, and Kennedy are all lone nuts, and I'm not sure any kind of rational calculation was part of what drove them.
Right, but anyone who thinks that this is an effective way to get rid of a chief executive that they don't like and don't like their policies, this is not good for the country. This is a terrible thing for the nation as a whole. David Priest?
Yeah, absolutely. It takes away from the people a decision that lies with the people, which is through an election or through acting in political parties in a primary system to nominate a candidate, or even through elected representatives, through a process like impeachment. Those are all methods by which the people directly or through a mediation mechanism decide who the leader of the country will be. Assassination does not do that. Assassination rips it out of the hands of the public and the representatives of the public and puts it in the hand of one person who thinks that he, or theoretically she, in the case of two assassins who attempted to take the life of Gerald Ford, that he or she knows better than the people that this person should not only be president, but whether this person should be alive at all. It's an affront to all of us and to our society.
Right. We got a tweet from an email from Christopher. What is the scholarly consensus regarding what counts as a transmittal related to the 25th Amendment? What about a tweet? Or consider a scenario where a sitting president fires most or all of his cabinet by tweet before the hard copy transmittal is delivered. So these are these, you know, we're in these mind games, these mind puzzles. David Priest?
Yeah, I cite in my book, absolutely wonderful book if you're interested in questions like this, as the person you just cited clearly is. And it's a book that looks at these constitutional crises that could develop, not a constitutional crisis in terms of, oh, the politics of this are difficult, or this is something in the Constitution that seems rough. But when there truly is some interpretation left open on a crucial issue within the Constitution. And that book by Brian Cult at Michigan State University is an absolutely wonderful book to look at if you're interested in such questions, because he drills down, and on almost all of them, he comes out saying, we just don't know, because these are things that have not happened. They're things that are open to interpretation. And on that issue, he says, yes, there is the opportunity for there to be two different schools of thought on what the transmittal is, whether the president firing the cabinet is a problem. But I got to tell you, in a case where there's a 25th Amendment declaration and the majority of the cabinet says the president is unable, if he immediately fires all of the cabinet, that could immediately trigger impeachment hearings for a president doing something that was, in a sense, an abuse of power.
So the impeachment, although it hasn't happened and it is difficult to achieve, it does act as a deterrent for presidents
Absolutely.
Doing things.
Absolutely. I can't remember the source of the quote now, but there was a good quote that I used in the book that, in fact, impeachments have not always been used, but you know what? Every president has been constrained by the possibility of impeachment being there. There are things that this president and perhaps previous presidents might have considered if they didn't have a lawyer whispering in their ear or their conscience saying, you know, they could kick you out of office for this.
Military coup is not something that has happened in the U.S. history, has happened in other countries. Is that something that presidents have to worry about along impeachments? David Crockett, you know, why haven't we ever had a military coup in the United States?
Well, ever since George Washington, we've had a very, very strong convention of civilian control over the military, and the military class has bought into that. So we don't have 7 days in May going on because, for the most part, we understand that that is the way we work in this country. And I think that's a pretty powerful norm. I do, something that's telling me, and your other guest probably knows this better than I do, that when Nixon was in his final days of decline, that I believe Alexander Haig told the chief military officers, if you get an order from the president, check with me first, which is not a military coup, but it's a cautionary note by a military officer in the Oval Office to beware of an unhinged president who's getting ready to leave office, what he might do.
So. And David Priest, you want to talk about that? When Nixon was in his cups, it was sure. quite a thing.
Yeah, Nixon is such a fascinating case on all of these methods of removing or disempowering a president, because yes, he was ultimately removed by the impeachment process, although he resigned. And there were people who considered, was he fit to serve as president in terms of being able? Sometimes it was due to drinking. He did turn to more and more drinking as the winds of Watergate blew. And there were people who basically avoided him, made decisions in his name. His chief of staff had done that from the beginning, but it accelerated during the final days of Watergate. The National Security Advisor, in one case, sent off a letter to the Soviet premier in Nixon's name without consulting Nixon during a Middle Eastern war that looked like it could be heading to a nuclear crisis. That's a huge step. The one story that was perhaps the most compelling but was the most frustratingly difficult to chase down was the claim that the Secretary of Defense himself said, if anyone in the military gets an order from the president, you got to check with me first, specifically regarding the use of nuclear weapons. Myself and another author who has written about similar issues both could not find a credible original source for this. It's one of those that was truthy enough that it has been handed down. And it may very well be true, but we felt a little bit unsure about it, given that we couldn't find the original source in an airtight way. So the way I wrote it right. in the book is that supposedly the Secretary of State or the Secretary
sure,
of
so
Defense
it's apocryphal, but that story has gained currency in recent
sure.
months because people have said about if you get a strange order from the current president right. about launching, we need to double check on that.
Yeah, and this fits in with the idea of removing a president in place. Usually you think of that as the opposition. For example, the Congress passing draconian laws that make the president the president's powers harder to execute. But I also address in the book the idea that sometimes, perhaps often, it's the president's own subordinates who block him from doing his job by not putting decision memos on his desk or taking away the ones that have been prepared for
right.
him.
Right. And we'll talk about that more when we come back from the break. We're talking about the powers of the presidency, how to neuter the president or remove them from office. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. You can call in with 210-614-8980 with your comments and questions. 210-614-8980. The Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. To remove a president, what does that take? How often does that happen? What are the options? David Priest, author of the book, How to Get Rid of a President, A History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. How many of our chief executives in the past would fit under that unpopular, unable, or unfit title?
Almost all of them, David, at one point in their presidency would be called one or more of those. Popularity is probably the easiest because at least going back for about a third of the country's history, we have reasonably reliable polls that tell us whether the president still has the backing of the majority of the people. But removing a president early is not a reaction to an unpopular president. You just wait till the next election. That's the primary means for that. The more difficult ones are an unable or an unfit president. And that's where we have to debate methods like impeachment and the 25th Amendment. Thankfully, those have happened less often. What did surprise me in the research for the book, however, was how often we've had at least temporarily disabled presidents, usually by the curse of depression. And one study about 10 years ago found that up to that point, about 25% of U.S. presidents at some point during their presidency suffered from what would now be considered a diagnosable mental disorder, usually depression.
Hey, and you mentioned we talked about Woodrow Wilson before the yeah. stroke. He was bedridden during the death of his first wife while he was in president. He was in a complete depression at that time.
Yeah, and I'd heard stories like that, or stories of Abraham Lincoln being very depressed upon the death of his son while in the White House. Of course, Lincoln somehow channeled that into his legendary empathy and connection with people. But I hadn't heard stories like that of Grover Cleveland, who in fact had a cancer discovery in his mouth at a time when you could not say the word cancer. It was the forbidden disease, a taboo. So instead of tell the people that he had cancer and he was undergoing surgery to get it out, putting the country into a state of uncertainty during a financial downturn, he decided to have risky surgery on the waves of the Atlantic Ocean on a boat while he was tied to a mast. That, to me, is riskier than telling the American people that you're having jaw surgery. But he was clearly disabled for a period of time during and after that surgery. Now, that was before nuclear weapons, so having the president available at a minute's notice was not the same as it is now. But there were many times when presidents clearly were not able to exercise the duties of the office at a particular time.
David Crockett, chair of the Political Science Department at Trinity University. We hear all the time that we cannot indict a sitting president, although we know that there have been numerous indictments from people connected to the president. Special counsel Robert Mueller's team has indicted or gotten guilty pleas from 34 people and three companies that we know of in the investigation, the latest one being Roger Stone. Why can't we indict the sitting president, and what would that mean if we could?
The basic idea here is that to be able to indict the president during for public duties while he's in public office would subject him to endless lawsuits and detract from his ability to do his job. So what typically happens is you just line up the charges for when he leaves office, which is one reason why Bill Clinton settled with Paula Jones while he was in office, because that was waiting for him when he left. But the idea is to protect the president and in his public capacity to do his public duties
without being subjected to all these other sorts of efforts.
If a president could be indicted while in office, would that cripple the power of the presidency, David Preece?
That's a yes and a no, which is a frustrating answer. I think Dr. Crockett has it right. The theory behind it is there's no shortage of people who don't like the president, any president, politically, personally, perhaps from previous business or previous interactions if they were a public servant. And there could be lawsuits left and right, and that would make it hard for any normal president to do his job. The no, however, is that there may be cases where the president himself would not be so burdened by an exceptional case that it needs to be ruled out. And I'm thinking here of the fact that we have a very large federal bureaucracy with executive departments, with millions of employees doing the job of the executive branch every single day that do not rely on the president's decisions. We have seen the president's schedules in this case. We've seen the president's public schedules showing that on many days he is in executive time and not necessarily in 12 hours of wall-to-wall meetings requiring imminent decisions on everything. That somewhat minimizes the argument that the president cannot possibly be hassled with an exceptional case that would involve an indictment, because the machinery of the executive branch carries on. It is still grinding, and most of the things that the government does still get done, even if the president decides that he doesn't want to be involved in them.
President Trump is complaining about these harassing investigations, that they are interfering with the operations of the executive branch. David Crockett, does that, you know, seem logical to you?
Well, it takes up time for his general counsel's office to deal with these sorts of things, but I think that's just more of a pique that he feels that he's having people question his integrity or question his background or question decisions he's made or engage in what he calls fake news. So,
well, this could just be the natural oversight function of the House of Representatives that the founders had envisioned.
Yes, although no president likes to have that much oversight, and I think it's one thing to have oversight over presidential decisions, so you're trying to find out information about how a decision was made or how things were operationalized. It's another thing to have people do so because they suspect foul play or malfeasance or that sort of a thing. That's a more threatening type of oversight. But, you know, when people engage in certain activities, they ask for that.
and David,
and it does take up some time then, because obviously, you know, presidents are human beings who work in our space-time continuum, so they only have 24 hours in the day. The more they're spending time worrying about these kinds of things and directing their office to be concerned with these kinds of things, the less time they are spending doing agenda setting, policy making, implementation of policy, handling crises, things like that.
David Preece, one thing you get at in your book, How to Get Rid of a President, is sometimes you can remove a president by not allowing them to become president. Can you explain?
Yeah, this was perhaps the funnest part of this history that I looked at, is I discovered in going back and reading a lot of the original sources is there were people who certainly had the resume to be president. In some cases, they had the political skill and the connections
and
to
the popular
be a
vote.
Very... Yeah, and a good president, and in many cases, some of them did win the popular vote, but by our mediated system of the Electoral College, they didn't make it in. And so the thought got into my mind, which is, can you imagine an eminently qualified candidate, somebody who looks so certain that they will be such a good president that they might be difficult to remove by any means once they are in office, which is essentially what happened with Franklin Roosevelt. The Republicans could not get him out of office. He kept getting reelected, and they had no significant way of pushing back on most of what he did, except for packing the courts with his own people. So the idea popped into my mind, well, is it essentially a preemptive removal if somebody uses not only regular political means, but maybe a little bit of trickery to keep someone out of office? And I found a few people who fit this bill. The earliest, probably Henry Clay. He should be a more prominent name in U.S. history than most of our people who did become president, because he was a remarkable man, serving in both the Senate, the House, serving as an overseas negotiator to end a war.
The Great Compromiser.
The Great Compromiser. And he did not get into the presidency, not exclusively, but largely because He became enemies with Andrew Jackson, who was not kind to his friends as well as to his enemies. And he kept Henry Clay out of office, along with some help from Clay's own political opponents within his party, for decades, when Henry Clay kept looking like he was the man who would win office. Now, part of that is Henry Clay's fault, in that he was a compromiser, and Americans love a clear winner. And when your main reputation is you find a way to get a deal done, that may sound good at some level, but it also sounds like you're compromising principles somewhere along the way. So Henry Clay never became president. He was probably the best president we never had.
Or Al Gore, who was not become didn't become president because of a Supreme Court decision. The Supreme Court has played quite many roles in deciding who gets to remain president. They decided that Richard Nixon had to turn over the tapes and limited executive power. And then they ruled that just because a president does it doesn't make it legal. Lots of ways that the system does come into play, and there are checks and balances, and they have worked in the past, David Crockett. So how much faith do you have in the system today?
So far, I have a lot of faith in the checks and balances system. I think the separation of powers kicks in, not always the way we would have thought, and sometimes in a rather clunky fashion, but even Donald Trump is experiencing the pains and anguish of a separation of powers system. Sometimes it comes from inside. The bureaucracy can push back, but Congress and the courts do tend to push back at some point, and ultimately you have this every 4 years, the people weighing in. I would not argue that we are immune to tyranny in this country, but I don't think we're seeing that right now.
David Priest, author of How to Get Rid of a President, what are your thoughts about where we are today and faith in checks and balances?
Yeah, there are two directions you can go, having looked at all of this history of our unable, unfit, unpopular presidents. One angle goes towards pessimism, which is we've elected all of these presidents who would not be characterized as great presidents, many of them as bad presidents. And what's wrong with our system that we can't get all of the best presidents in office? The other way to look at this is one of negativity, one of pessimism. And I don't like that one. The one I go towards instead is the one of optimism, which is we've had all of these bad presidents, and yet we have enough ways in our system without ripping the country apart and having a civil war every time by which we can remove that president and move on to somebody else. And we've not just survived, but we've thrived as a nation by doing that. So I think we're doing okay.
David Priest is the author of How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. He's also a former CIA intelligence officer. David Crockett is chair of the Political Science Department at Trinity University. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.